On Friday, April 26th, agents of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms arrested the leader of the Georgia Republic Militia and an associate on the charge of conspiring, quote, to possess unregistered explosive devices, or more specifically, pipe bombs. Naturally, the disturbing news was splashed across the nation and even made international headlines. When CBS News claimed, and listen very closely, ladies and gentlemen, that the militiamen had plotted to use the bombs in a terrorist act aimed at the upcoming Olympics in Atlanta. In a May 6th preliminary hearing held in Macon, Georgia, the two defendants, Robert E. Starr III and William J. McCraney, were brought before U.S. Magistrate Richard L. Hodge. At this hearing, Starr's attorney, Dr. Nancy Lohr, argued that DATF confidential informants who had infiltrated the small militia group had actually planted the bomb-making material themselves. This was broken as a headline story in Veritas magazine some months ago. In fact, within 2 or 3 weeks of the arrest of McCraney and Starr. The government's case is built on the premise that Starr and McCraney had conspired to build pipe bombs, and they presented as evidence the fact that they had discovered, quote, bomb-making materials, end quote, buried in two locations in Crawford County, one where McCraney lives and another on land owned by Starr. According to militia members who have signed sworn affidavits, two men reputed to be the government's informants had discussed building the pipe bombs for home defense. The discussions occurred at an April 23rd militia meeting, after which several of the other militia members approached Starr and told him that they were opposed to the bomb-making plan discussed by the two men. They contend that Starr reassured them that he had no intention of going along with the two informants' plan. As for McCraney, the Macon, Georgia Telegraph on May 7th exposed a critical government admission revealed during the preliminary hearing. Pay very close attention, ladies and gentlemen. And I quote directly from the Macon, Georgia Telegraph on May 7th. Quote, Agent Stephen W. Gillis of the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms also acknowledged that Starr's co-defendant, William James, Jimmy McCraney, had said, quote, I don't want to know anything about it, end quote, and walked away when the government's informant was talking about building bombs, end quote. Note, ladies and gentlemen, that the government informant was talking about building bombs, not Starr and not McCraney, which supports the defense's charge of entrapment. In fact, Starr's attorney, Nancy Lohr, goes one step further. Lohr, who was the 1992 Libertarian Party candidate for vice president, charged, quote, this is beyond entrapment. It is manufactured evidence. The materials were put on Mr. Starr's property without his knowledge. The whole evidence upon which this case was based was fraudulent, end quote. The revealing Macon Telegraph article continued, quote, a federal agent testified Monday that Starr was not present when alleged pipe bomb components were buried on his property, and the agent admitted that he did not know for sure whether Robert Edward Starr III was aware the materials were there, end quote. The Telegraph added that Dr. Lohr accused the ATF confidential informants of being sent in to infiltrate and set up the militia group. Quote, Lord said it was the agent provocateurs who actually buried the pipes and chemicals on Starr's property, which made it easy for agents to find them when they got a search warrant. He said, and I quote, you went right to it. You didn't have to search the whole 16 acres, did you? End quote, Lord asked. FBI agent Gillis conceded agents did not. They went in exactly right to the specific spot. Lohr had maintained that there is no conspiracy when all the participants but one are government agents, according to the Telegraph's Audrey Holstein. Quote, Gillis had just testified that someone other than the government's informants had shown up to McCraney's place the day the materials were to be moved to Starr's property, which would have met the legal definition of a conspiracy. When Lord asked Gillis whether this other militia member actually participated in moving the materials, prosecutor Sharon Ratley objected, again citing the need to protect identity. The truth is, ladies and gentlemen, the truth is that there was no militia member. All of these materials were moved and buried at the specific site by agent provocateurs of the United States government being paid to do so. If they had failed in doing so, they would not have been paid. Ratley objected repeatedly when Lord pressed Agent Gillis, asking him whether anyone other than Starr and the government's informants took part in discussions or activities concerning the pipe bomb. Ratley contended that the identities of the confidential informants, would then be revealed, to which Lord countered, "With all due respect, the identity has been revealed." The judge finally instructed Gillis to answer the question of whether this other militia member had actually participated. The alcohol, tobacco, and firearms agent admitted, quote, "I don't know what the other individual did," end quote. In fact, Gillis's evidence was based on an ambiguous tape recording. Quote, "The agent acknowledged that he had no way of knowing from the informant's tape recording whether the group was talking about bombs or survival gear when members talked about needing supplies," end quote. Nevertheless, federal agent Stephen Gillis appears content to help send two men to jail for many years on these disgracefully flimsy and quite probably manufactured charges. Ohio militia leader J.J. Johnson, who attended the trial and testified as a character witness for Starr, cited the following additional holes in the government's case as they were revealed by cross-examination of Agent Gillis. 1. Bob Starr did not want bomb-making materials on his property and did not have possession of any bomb-making materials. 2. There never were any completed pipe bombs, and the bomb-making factory alluded to in media reports consisted of two small sandwich bags of legally obtainable chemicals such as sodium perchlorate powder, aluminum, and a clumpy white mixture not yet analyzed. After 10 days, this is number 3, after 10 days, the chemicals found on Starr's property still had not been analyzed by any scientific laboratory. If, as the hearing's evidence suggests, the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms informants planted the materials, there would be no need to test the chemicals. They would already know what they were. 4, government informants planted the evidence, the bomb-making material on Starr's property, and it has not yet been ascertained through chemical analysis that any of these chemicals, when put together, would actually make any bomb. How about that? Number 5, McCraney was not at the meeting to discuss bomb making and wanted nothing to do with making bombs. In fact, observers we interviewed had no idea why the man was even being held. As Johnson's wife, Helen, asked, quote, "Has it occurred to anyone that the wrong guys are in jail?" End quote. But ladies and gentlemen, why didn't Starr simply say no to the illegal schemes and settle the whole thing right from the beginning? Well, attorney Lord claims that her client had suspected a government setup and was attempting to determine who in his militia group had instigated the talk of bomb making. He did not know whether it was the two men doing the talking or someone else, and was, according to Lord, conducting an internal investigation of the organization he founded. Lord insisted Mr. Starr was arrested not because he intended to build those bombs, but because he intended not to. In fact, the night after the meeting where the alleged pipe bomb discussions occurred, Starr phoned in to the popular shortwave program of J.J. Johnson, himself a militia leader from Ohio. The tape is being used as evidence by the defense and has already been played to the court. Johnson told Relevant that Starr alerted the listening audience to the kind of unscrupulous tactics to expect from federal law enforcement. He made specific reference to attempts by law enforcement to infiltrate groups with agents provocateurs who might then attempt to entrap or frame the group's members with illegal acts. Starr also told Johnson off the air that a friendly FBI acquaintance had warned him earlier that day of an anonymous threat against his, Starr's, life. It was for this reason that Starr decided to refer on the air to the federal entrapment tactics. Did Starr's comments prompt the alcohol, tobacco, and firearms to hurriedly set the hook on their sting operation? Well, the Telegraph article states, and I quote, Gillis confirmed the FBI said it had received the death threat against Starr, but he said there was no connection between Starr's calling the radio show and ATF's decision to get the warrants against Starr and McCraney the next day. End quote. And that's right. They obtained the arrest warrants the day after the Wednesday radio show and took the two into custody the following day. Gadsden, Alabama militia leader Jeff Randall, who like Johnson is a personal friend of Starr's, told Relevance, quote, look at the chronology of events. The ATF admitted that they would have had a better case if they had waited until the components were assembled, end quote. That would have been on the Saturday when the alleged bomb-making session was to take place at Starr's property. Randall believes that the only reason the men were arrested earlier, before they had any hard evidence, is that Starr's shortwave show tipped off the feds that he was on to their entrapment scheme. Randall added, quote, ATF admitted that the pipes had not even been fingerprinted and that the chemical was not tested to see if it would even explode, end quote, and therefore, how can they be charged with possessing unregistered explosive material? What is going on, ladies and gentlemen? This is not standard FBI or even basic police technique. This is a framework. Again, you see, there would be no reason to take fingerprints or test the chemicals to see if they would explode if the agents knew that their informants alone had planted the evidence. Jeff Randall, who has been gathering information on Starr's behalf, disclosed that the defense has lined up numerous witnesses who will testify that, quote, the only ones involved in the bomb-making talk or activity were the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms informants, end quote. Randall and Johnson also revealed that the defense has obtained a copy of internal documents from the ATF showing that the confidential informants were paid to infiltrate the group. It has recently been revealed that they were paid $50,000. As to Robert Starr's record, although federal agents claimed they had investigated Starr for similar conspiracies in the past, the self-employed electrician has never been charged and has absolutely no criminal record. As to his character, Randall noted, quote, I know he's totally innocent. I wouldn't be hanging my butt on the line for somebody who was planning to make bombs. I don't support terrorists, end quote. And neither does any other legitimate militia in this country. The Macon Telegraph quoted his former office manager, Linda King, as saying, quote, I don't believe there's a mean bone in his body, end quote. Over 75 militia members and local supporters packed the courthouse for the preliminary hearing and found twice as many law enforcement officers waiting for them. What did they think they were going to do? Among their activities, quote, local, state, and federal officers snapped pictures as militia supporters quietly gathered in small groups under shade trees, end quote. Notably, the militia members snapped right back with cameras of their own, and well they should. A few weeks prior, ladies and gentlemen, to the incident, the Georgian had told Randall that he was conducting an investigation into his militia and that he wanted to meet with him to discuss at a later date. Other members of Starr's group have told Randall that the two purported government informants were the only ones who ever discussed the illegal acts. But isn't it outrageous to suggest, and I know many of you are thinking this, isn't it outrageous, insulting to suggest that federal agents would do something so despicable as to plant evidence on innocent people in an attempt to put them behind bars for many, many years? Actually, they've done it all before, ladies and gentlemen, and worse. In 1990, Ward Churchill and Jim Vander Wall wrote the COINTELPRO papers, documents from the FBI's secret wars against dissent in the United States. The name, the term, COINTELPRO, pronounced co-in-tel-pro, is a contraction of counterintelligence program, which was, and likely still is, official denial, notwithstanding a domestic anti-dissent operation which apparently targets any group at all, or groups that deviate too far from the establishment's game plan for America, which is to march directly into the New World Order, the New World totalitarian socialist state without a whimper. Remember, peace is defined by Lenin as the absence of opposition to socialism. The book used numerous references, including the huge state of documents released during a brief congressional crackdown on how our secret police agencies and others obtained under the Freedom of Information Act to chronicle federal law enforcement abuses during the 60s and 70s. The book printed one quote from Goldstein's Political Repression in Modern America, which has particular relevance to the Georgia case. And I quote directly from the book. Probably the most well-known agent provocateur was Thomas Tongyai, known as Tommy the Traveler. Tongyai, who was paid by both the FBI and local police, spent over 2 years traveling among colleges in western New York State, urging students to kill police, make bombs, and blow up buildings. He supplied students with radical speakers organized by SDS conferences in Rochester and urged students to participate in the Weatherman, quote, Days of Rage, end quote, in Chicago in October 1969. Tongyai constantly talked violence, carried a grenade in his car, showed students how to use an M1 rifle, and offered advice on how to carry out bombings. These are from pages 474 to 475, emphasis in original, from the congressional investigation on COINTELPRO. Tommy, the FBI provocateur, did the talking. The gullible student radicals did the listening and the dirty work. From the report again, quote, after some students at Hobart College apparently took his advice and bombed the Hobart ROTC building and Tongyai's cover was exposed, the local sheriff commented, quote, there's a lot of difference between showing how to build a bomb and building one, end quote. As a result of Tongyai's activities on the Hobart campus, 9 students and faculty faced criminal charges, but Tongyai was cleared by a local grand jury and went on to become a policeman in Pennsylvania. See, for reference, The Agent Provocateur as Folk Hero by Frank Donner and the issue of Civil Liberties dated September 1971. Political repression in modern America relates yet another of the numerous cases of FBI informants creating crimes from scratch. Quote, probably the most incredible provocation incident involved an FBI and Seattle police informer, Alfred Burnett, who lured Gary Eugene Ward into planting a bomb at a Seattle real estate office on the morning of May 15, 1970, by paying Ward $75, providing him with a bomb, and giving him transportation to the bombing scene. Page 473. Ward, a twice wounded, thrice decorated Vietnam veteran, was, quote, shot and killed by waiting Seattle police as he allegedly fled after the bombing attempt, although he was unarmed, on foot, and boxed in by police cars, end quote.
Into the hour of the time, I'm William Cooper, the man that President Clinton wrote in a White House memo is the most dangerous radio host in America, and Rush Limbaugh read it on the air in order to take the heat off of himself. Even though to this day he still bills himself as the most dangerous man in America, that proved him to be a liar. Why am I the most dangerous radio host in America, ladies and gentlemen? Because I tell the truth. Simply because I tell the truth. I document it. I back it up with sources so that you can go out and obtain the exact same documentation. Why did he call me the most dangerous radio host in America? Because I know that Bill Clinton is a communist, his wife is a communist, and they are destroying this country with their fellow travelers placed in key strategic locations throughout the bureaucracy of the United States of America and the individual states. How else could all this be happening to us? How else could this nation be coming apart at the seams? Why has all this been happening? You used to blame it on the Soviet Union, and you were right, because the leadership always came from there. The funding always came from there. But you might say, even if there are a few quixotic communists inside this country still trying to fight the revolution with psychopolitics, how can they pose a threat since communism itself has been dead since the end of the Cold War? Well, you could ask that if you haven't been paying attention and you really don't understand what's happening and you really haven't done any research other than tuning into the 6 o'clock news and listening to the lies from Dan Rather, Peter Jennings, Craig Koppel, Connie Chung, and all the others. You see, unfortunately, as crazy as it sounds, communism was never dead. If you read Mikhail Gorbachev's Perestroika, he told you in there, he told you the truth, that it is a scam to force the West to lower its guard. Communism is in the process of being resurrected right at this moment, ladies and gentlemen, without rehashing all of our evidence. We refer you to the December 1995 issue of Relevance Magazine, Planning for the Soviet Reunion, the January 1996 issue, The Changing of the Guard, and the exhaustively documented Fall 1994 special report, The New Lies Strategy. See also Relevance March 1995, and hours and hours and hours of broadcasts of the hour of the time where I sat here and documented and read you the documents and the sources where you can get them over and over and over again for going on just 5 years now. The planning for a Soviet reunion continues apace with another big step in the left direction. On the Ides of March 1996, the Russian Parliament voted for a resolution denouncing the 1991 dissolution of the Soviet Union as illegal. This is viewed, ladies and gentlemen, inside Russia as being the prelude to the quickening process of reconsolidating the old Soviet Union. The press may banter about that it is fractured into independent states and ethnic territories that have all become democratic and are being led by great democratic leaders. A quick review of the background of those so-called democratic leaders reveals them to be lifelong staunch communists. There has been no changing of the guard. This process was almost matter-of-factly predicted by Anatoly Golitsyn in his 1984 book entitled New Lies for Old, before old Gorby or his Glasnost scam, also predicted by Golitsyn, had even appeared in the list. Of course, the reconstitution of the Soviet Union could never occur without the orchestrated sham breakup of the Soviet Union in the first place. Now that vast concessions have been extracted from the gullible West, and we are disarming and chopping our B-52 bombers into three parts in an Arizona desert, dismantling our Minuteman missiles and intercontinental ballistic missiles and destroying these missile sites. Oh, yes. Vast concessions have been extracted from the global West. Billions of dollars. We're beginning to see further evidence that Golitsyn was right all along. You see, the New York Times of March 22, 1996 revealed, and I quote, General Verinikov, who helped the abortive coup against Mikhail S. Gorbachev in 1991, warned an audience of Russian army officers last Saturday not to worry that Communist Party chief Mr. Zyuganov is, quote, sliding towards social democratic values, end quote. The general said the party still has a clear but unpublished plan, a clear but unpublished plan, a maximum program for restoring a socialist state which would be put into action after the elections, end quote. Maximum plan was the Bolshevik term for their long-term goals of creating a socialist world order. Maximum plan was the Bolshevik term for the long-term goals of creating a socialist world order, and the general use of the phrase has stirred waves of shock speculation among intellectuals and journalists. Why was Zyuganov's response to the general's comment? What was it? He said, quote, it was a slip of the tongue, Mr. Zyuganov said on Tuesday, insisting that there is no secret plan. And of course, I believe him, don't you? Naturally, the vast majority of well-educated readers of the New York Times were instantly reassured by Comrade Zyuganov's clarifying statement. The trusting souls know, beyond any doubt, that the Cold War is over, and the Russians are all Democrats, even the communists, after all. After all, ladies and gentlemen, they read it in the New York Times. Any doubt that the KGB cycled politicians have a sense of humor was dispelled by the hilarious coup in August of 1991, in which the stone-faced plotters came down with bouts of flu and gave in to mighty Democrat Boris Yeltsin, appearing as himself in the unforgettable tank mounting scene. There is no denying their gift for satire, not to mention showmanship. The only question is, how do they keep a straight face when delivering lines like Zyuganov, quote, it was a slip of the tongue, end quote, or when their brilliant young comic actor Vladimir Zhirinovsky voiced his support for Pat Buchanan? Oh, man, I rolled on the ground. Oh, the guy was laughing over that one. And when he did it, he granted his distractors one final embarrassing coup de grace with which to finish his candidacy. And he did it on purpose. Yes, folks, the KGB's Moscow troops has been turning in Oscar-caliber performances for 5 years, but remains largely undiscovered, not only by Hollywood talent scouts, but also by Western journalists. Or maybe the humor is just too dry for American taste or perception. For America, maybe Americans have grown stupid. Even if the psycho-politic techniques are being used by resurgent Russian communists, we won't be affected by it, is the strain I often hear. Not so fast there, buddy. The Philadelphia Inquirer's August 20th, 1995 Sunday magazine carried a cover story cheerfully titled Paranoid Politics: The Blurry Line Between Extremism and Madness. In it, we were introduced to Gerald Post, a professor of political psychiatry at George Washington University and the former director of the Central Intelligence Agency's Psychological Unit. I read this directly out of his biography. The professor tells us that paranoia is part of the human condition. It exists in some measure, in all of us. Yes, and it will exist in quite a few more of us when the full implications of political psychiatry sink in. Although the Inquirer doesn't admit it, the concept of a psychiatrist treating one's political views raises the specter of Soviet psychiatrists treating dissidents. In fact, ladies and gentlemen, doesn't it sound an awful lot like the above quote from that outdated psychopolitical manual from the 30s? But oddly enough, the Inquirer article provides the following little curio. Post is, quote, near completion of a book called The Psychopolitics of Hatred. And I'll be the first one to let you know, ladies and gentlemen, when that book comes out. Ex-CIA man Post, and I've got to tell you right now, there is no such thing as an ex-CIA man. Never was. Is not now and never can or will be. There is no ex-CIA man. Post is not the only doctor dabbling in political psychiatry. You see, the March 5th, 1996 edition of the Detroit News carried a column by psychiatrist turned neoconservative columnist Charles Krauthammer, which appeared under the heading The Paranoid Fantasies of Pat Buchanan. And after a long list of half-truths in which he attempts to show how simply crazy it is to think of the United Nations, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organization as threats to United States sovereignty, he closes the piece with the following line. Quote, when I was a psychiatrist, I had patients with similar fantasies. Some even thought they were presidents. Not one, however, actually ran for the office, end quote. So Dr. Krauthammer has apparently returned to clinical practice as a psychopolitician, and he has diagnosed patient candidate Buchanan as suffering from paranoia. Only now, he is sharing his patient's diagnosis with his readers across the country. But his disregard for doctor-patient confidentiality is surpassed by an even more reckless disregard for the facts, ladies and gentlemen. For instance, Krauthammer states, quote, the notion that the United Nations, a moribund, bankrupt, entirely dependent organization, threatens American sovereignty and independence is simply crazy, end quote. And he should know. He is, after all, a psychiatrist. Still, the notion that an organization which has gone from an international joke to the recognized arbiter of world peace and security in the space of less than 6 years is entitled to at least a little respect. And whether the good doctor realizes it or not, the world body has gained more than a little respect from our own military brass. The April 1995 edition of Special Warfare, the official quarterly of the United States Army, John F. Kennedy Special Warfare Center and School in Fort Bragg, North Carolina, exposes the prevailing view of the United Nations within our military establishment. Listen carefully. The cover story is entitled Ambushing the Future and is written by James J. Schneider, a professor of military theory at the School of Advanced Military Studies, United States Army Command and General Staff College, Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Schneider predicts that the future will be dominated by a resurgent force that will change the nature of both the nation state and the national security system. Do you have any guess as to what that resurgent force might be? Well, folks, Schneider continues. He says, in other words, to learn from the past, we must anticipate the future, and the future will be dominated by a single overwhelming presence, the United Nations. The resurgence and the growing influence of the United Nations will not only affect our soldiers, but may change the very structure of the nation state, end quote. Crowdhammer laughs at the notion of a United Nations threat against United States sovereignty, while this army expert accepts our domination as a done deal. In addition, the United States Army even court-martialed a young medic named Michael New for refusing to wear the uniform of Crowdhammer's moribund, entirely defeated organization. You see, the problem with articles like Schneider and the case of Michael New is that it tends to undermine Dr. Crowdhammer's diagnosis of Pat Buchanan's paranoia pattern. Could it be that the good doctor is spending more time reading Psychology Today than he is reading Special Warfare and other journals that might better assist him in what his fellow psychiatrists call reality testing? Schneider notes that the United Nations has become a pliable, occasional useful creature of American foreign policy. We send it into fire patches we wish to stay out of. Bosnia, for example. This dude forgets that we weren't able to stay out of the Bosnian fire patch. Right now, this moment, as I speak, there are over 20,000 United States troops and 17,000 support personnel over there in Bosnia right now working for NATO.
Destroy them.
Crowdhammer, a foreign policy professional and member of the Council on Foreign Relations, then makes a misleading distinction between NATO and the hopelessly ineffective United Nations. Presumably, he is unaware that the former, NATO, operates within the framework of and is subservient to the latter as a regional arm of the United Nations. As I have emphasized to you repeatedly, as I have documented on the air, reading to you from the law, from the treaty, from the United Nations Charter, from the NATO Charter, from the North Atlantic Treaty Organization Charter, the regional security agency known as the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, or NATO, was formed pursuant to Chapter 7, Article 52 of the United Nations Charter. In addition, Article 53 states, quote, Security Council shall, where appropriate, utilize the regional arrangements or agencies for enforcement action under its authority, but no enforcement action shall be taken under regional arrangements or by regional agencies without the authorization of the United Nations Security Council. That's why Article 6 of the Dayton Peace Agreement stipulates that, quote, the United Nations Security Council will establish IFOR, the NATO force in Bosnia, acting under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter. So behind Charles Krauthammer's back, the United Nations Security Council gets to decide if and when it wishes to use regional agencies like NATO and its American troops, and if it so chooses, it will use them under its authority. See, you've been taken for a ride. When Bill Clinton lied to the American people and said we were sending troops under NATO, not under the United Nations, and that they would only be there for 1 year, he blatantly did not lie. He lied. He knew that he lied. He did it intentionally. They are under United Nations command, and the Dayton Agreement specified 5 years, not 1. Good night, ladies and gentlemen. Good night. pull the wool out from over your eyes. Stop being people and become real people. Good night, and God bless each and every single one of you.